I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. According to a survey by the Knight Foundation, fewer than half of Americans can identify even one source of news that they trust. Today on Midday, a conversation about journalism in the age of the 24-hour news cycle and the quest for corporate profits. Jill Abramson began her career as a reporter during the Watergate era. She rose to become the executive editor of the New York Times. In her new book, she chronicles the evolution of the Times, the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, Vice, and Facebook, and explores how each organization navigates the tension between editorial excellence and the bottom line. The book is called Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. Jill Abramson joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Thanks, Andy, and thanks to everybody who's made a contribution in our spring membership drive. We very much appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. We hear from a lot of people during this drive and at other times that one of the reasons they listen to WIPR and NPR is that they consider this a trusted and credible source for news and information. A recent survey conducted by the Knight Foundation reported that fewer than half of Americans, 44%, can identify even one source of news that they find trustworthy. President Trump, of course, has for years derided the press as the enemy of the people, and there are plenty of people, apparently, who agree with him. Today on Midday, a conversation with a journalist whose unique experience makes her a compelling observer of the craft and business of journalism and the changing nature of how and from whom we get our news. Jill Abramson began her career as a reporter during the Watergate era. She spent almost a decade at the Wall Street Journal, and she was the first woman to be appointed as the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times, where she rose to become the Gray Lady's executive editor. After 3 years in that position in 2014, she was fired in favor of the current executive editor, Dean Baquet. Jill Abramson has written a fascinating book that explores how both legacy and more recently formed news organizations navigate the tension between the aspiration to publish accurate, thorough stories about the important issues of the day and the need to make enough profit from publishing those stories on a variety of platforms to sustain and grow their businesses. The book is called Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. Jill Abramson joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
I have to tell you that this is a terrific book, an absolutely fascinating read, very compelling, very interesting. And we have to start, however, with some controversy that has surrounded the book. You profile five news organizations, if you count Facebook as one of those, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Vice News, and BuzzFeed. A reporter from Vice News, Michael Moynihan, he's a correspondent on that program, Vice News Tonight, which airs on HBO. He levied charges of plagiarism and tweeted several examples where he cited sources from places like the Ryerson Review of Journalism, the New Yorker Magazine. There was even a master's thesis thrown in there, the Columbia Journalism Review, and then put them up next to excerpts from the book. So let me ask you to respond to those charges, which came out, you know, right when the book was published about a month ago.
Right. Almost exactly on its publication day, in fact. Well, I can say with complete confidence that there's no example of plagiarism in the book. What Mr. Moynihan pointed out were six passages that were improperly missed in the footnoting process, all from a section of the book dealing with Vice's early years. And, you know, in the case of four of them, four of the sources, I credit them sometimes multiple times, even that dissertation you mentioned, elsewhere in the footnotes. So it doesn't quite make sense that I would be crediting sources while stealing from them. I've said that this was, you know, a sloppy mistake, an error that, you know, I deeply regret. I feel terrible that there's even one mistake in this book. But, you know, at the same time, there are 835 credit citations in 70 pages of footnotes in this book. So I made every effort I knew how to credit anyone whose information or phrasing I used and to credit them. And in these few cases, I failed.
So is it an issue of indexing then, or did you fail in that, in hindsight, it would have been better to put those passages in quotes?
Yes, some of them, you know, could have been better in quotes, but it wasn't indexing. It was a system of footnoting I was using. And how deep in the weeds do you want me to get?
Well, I don't want to belabor it because it's been out there in the press and a number of people, you know, a number of publications picked up the story after those tweets, and you've had a chance to respond. I just want to make sure that, you know, for listeners who have read your book and who perhaps have read something about it in this regard, you know, got to hear from you right at the top about those that situation. But I do want to move on to the book, which, as I said, I found really compelling. The other tricky bit of navigating that you had to do is that you are a former employee of the New York Times, and you were in fact fired from a very senior position there as the executive editor. And I thought you were very candid and very open about your capacity to write about the New York Times, because the Times, as I mentioned, is one of the four big organizations plus Facebook that you chronicle here. But talk about your ability to you know, to write credibly and objectively about a place you worked at for the longest of times, and a place that you left, at least at that time in 2014, on pretty bad terms.
That's all true, and the passages in the book about my career and the end of it were necessary because some of the issues that were, you know, battled over hit to the heart of the book, you know, which is some of the tension between news and news gathering and that need to always be producing new revenue streams. So, you know, it was, you know, part of the larger story I was telling. It's the only part of the book that I write in first person because, you know, would have been, I think, really strained and not credible to try to write about myself as Abramson. And, you know, I'm glad that you found that section candid because, you know, I tried to be, you know, self-critical and not, you know, settling any scores with the New York Times. I still worship the New York Times. I think it's, you know, an irreplaceable institution in the world, and I root for its success every day. So, you know, I was very careful about, you know, the tone and substance of that section of the book. But it was hard to write. I mean, that was a painful period of my life. And, you know, I tried to be, you know, authentic, honest, and candid about what I perceive to have happened. And obviously, you know, say in the text, you know, that it's from my point of view and how I remember living through this period. So, you know, others may disagree.
You write about the perceived notion that publications like The Times and The Post and even newer things, BuzzFeed, Vice News, etc., are part of, they're often criticized for being part of the liberal media. We hear this from conservative media all the time, and it's the attenuation of the firewall between the editorial side, the business side, that can perhaps exacerbate that. Right in the prologue to the book, you said even you as an executive editor and the others who held similar positions at other places were expected to be digital gurus and let business imperatives guide their editorial judgment. Is the fact that those imperatives are perhaps guiding editorial decisions, is that making, in fact, these publications liberal in their political, philosophical point of view in places other than the op-ed page, in places like A1 of the New York Times or the Post?
Well, yeah, I think the most interesting, coverage to analyze through that lens is, all of the many news stories that appear every day in everyone's news report, particularly the Times and the Post, who have been in a kind of old-fashioned newspaper war, battling each other for the most tantalizing scoop, often about the Mueller investigation and corruption inside the Trump administration. And, it's a certainty that Donald Trump has been, good for business, not only at the Times and the Post, which have signed up many more digital subscribers since his election. That's called the Trump bump. And, the audiences for, cable TV shows have never been bigger. And, this has been a kind of gold mine for the news media. Now, that doesn't mean I'm suggesting that anyone does Trump stories simply because they're very popular, get lots of clicks, and, help these organizations make money. But, it's one of the implicit rewards in doing so.
Given the fact that the profile of a so-called typical reader of the New York Times or the Washington Post is perhaps left of center, there is a financial incentive to run Trump stories and to even run negative Trump stories. Is Trump being treated any differently than Obama or Bush or Clinton or the Bush before that?
I think he is being treated differently, but I think he deserves to be treated differently. I don't think we've seen so early in an administration. I mean, there were obviously various scandals like Travelgate at the beginning of Clinton, but we've not seen anything on the scale of this. A full-blown criminal investigation into collusion, obstruction of justice, and violation of election laws. So, I think that this administration, in its chaos, in its musical chairs version of filling and unfilling cabinet jobs, often relating to corruption allegations against particular Trump officials, that the coverage is merited and it is different. I think it's also sometimes on the news pages different in tone. I see from time to time, and kept a folder with some of them, paragraphs that were intended to be analytical but sounded quite opinionated. And I still see those and in certain headlines. And what I worry about most is I see raw opinion in the tweets of some of the reporters I respect and read the most. And that's true when they appear on cable panels, too.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk about that when we come back from a break. Jill Abramson, she's the former executive editor of the New York Times. We're talking about her latest book, Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. And Ms. Abramson, we're going to ask your indulgence while we take a break to talk to our listeners about the importance of supporting public radio. We will have more with Jill Abramson in just a little bit, but we do want to pause to remind you that we are in day three of our spring membership campaign. Andy Bienstock joins us once again to tell you how easy it is to become a member of your public radio. Thank you, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who's made a pledge so far. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it'll be the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Jill Abramson. She held several senior editorial positions at the New York Times until 2014. Now she's a senior lecturer at Harvard University and a columnist for The Guardian. Her new book is called Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. So, Jill, when we left off before that little pledge break, we were talking about the tension between maintaining objectivity and repertorial independence and letting your personal feelings be known in the form of tweets. You talk about some of the folks at the Times and the Post and other publications getting very lucrative contracts with places like CNN and MSNBC and Fox News to be contributors that bump their income up considerably, and they are there in these scrums of talking heads, and it's often very difficult to see if there's much difference between them as reporters and these folks who are there specifically to be opinionated. How should folks like Maggie Haberman and Peter Baker and folks who are currently with the Times, what are the metrics for how they should guide themselves in that situation?
Well, the metrics I always used and encouraged reporters at the Times to follow, pretty simple, like what you say in public, and that would include tweets and obviously TV appearances, should be consistent with the kinds of things and tone and words that you use, in the news report of the Times. That should be consistent. And, if some restraint or carefulness with words is being applied to what you file for the Times, that should apply to any other platform. And I want to say that, Maggie and Peter, I think, are both quite careful and punctilious about what they say on these cable shows. But the problem is that often, like, the lead-in to, the host's question can be very loaded. And, in responding, there's almost an implicit connection between tone of question and answer. And when you're wedged between, a Democratic consultant and a former prosecutor, it's hard for the audience, I think, with three people talking, to always keep straight who's the distanced, dispassionate journalism voice. Those are the issues. I certainly wouldn't ban, reporters from having these contracts, but, I would maybe discourage try to negotiate a better platform for them to talk about their own work.
I was intrigued to be told in your book that Maggie Haberman is the daughter of Clyde Haberman, who was for a long time a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Also very intrigued that Andy Samberg, the actor, was a carpool buddy of the guy who founded BuzzFeed, Jonah Peretti, which is very interesting. But when we talk about the church and state walls that are falling down, it used to be the wall between the editorial side and the advertisers. That has certainly been attenuated quite significantly, not just by the new media, not just by Vice and BuzzFeed and places like that, but even with the Times and the Post. Even in the way the headlines are written sometimes, or the way the stories are positioned, the wall between the editorial page, the op-ed page, the Tom Friedman's and the Ross Douditz of the world, and the reporting that's happening in the front part of the paper edition, that tends to start breaking down as well. And there's this other dimension of something called native advertising, which was certainly not pioneered by the Times or the Post, but the Times and the Post and everybody else has adopted it. Explain what that is and why that can be potentially very pernicious.
Native advertising, it's also called brand advertising, is, you know, ads that mimic very closely, you know, the content and storytelling style of whatever publication or television broadcast news show they're, you know, the advertisement for. And, you know, they're written in many cases by, you know, freelance journalists. And, you know, often how they're promoted on a homepage, let's say, you know, BuzzFeed's, you know, homepage, it's hard to distinguish them. They have, you know, sometimes a little color code, or the Times calls them paid posts, but you have to be paying close attention to, you know, realize they aren't just some kind of feature story. And, you know, I prefer a world where, you know, the reader or the audience always knows what's news and what's advertising.
And Jonah Peretti, who began his career or had part of his career at the Huffington Post before he founded BuzzFeed, had a completely different orientation for the editorial judgments that they were making. You call him a contagious media designer. The whole idea was to post stories that got lots of clicks, that got lots of people sharing those stories on other social media platforms. And this started with Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post. Give us a thumbnail sketch of that history and how things developed to the point where now you have, you know, direct partnerships between corporate sponsors and the editorial content that's often available on places like BuzzFeed.
Well, how it started is Jonah Peretti was studying at the MIT Media Lab, and he became just completely fascinated with what made people first click on, but then more importantly, share information and stories. And the origin story for how Peretti became the master of virality was he wanted to order a pair of custom-made Nike shoes that said sweatshop on the sole. And Nike refused to make these sneakers. And Jonah Peretti sort of emailed up the corporate line every time, sort of being given a vaguely different reason for why they wouldn't be made. And he had just posted the entire communication chain on the web, and it went viral within just a few days. Like, hundreds of thousands of people had read these emails. And he kept, you know, running experiments like that to purposely make information go viral. And he continued experimenting, yes, at the Huffington Post, but then he was able to raise money and fund his own company, BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed was based on sharing and virality. It was built on the back of Facebook's news feed. And as we know, the almighty Facebook algorithm is all based on what people click on and then what they share. And it feeds them more and more things that are like the previous things they've liked and shared. And BuzzFeed built a huge audience very quickly and, you know, attracted and only did native advertising. It signed up lots of big companies like Purina to, you know, do these storytelling videos that, you know, really look no different from, you know, the adorable kittens that were featured, you know, in the non-advertising part of BuzzFeed.
He went after a specific kind of reader of BuzzFeed. He called them super sharers. So he was actually tailoring the content to people who he knew were or had a proclivity for sharing the stories. Because the more shares, the more looks, the more he could charge for advertising.
That's right. Scale mattered. But he also called the audience the Bored at Work Network because, you know, they were people who worked in front of a screen and, you know, when the bosses weren't looking, they were busy on their news feeds. He wanted to give them, you know, delightful, funny content, you know, things like quizzes, what Disney princess are you? And when I started researching...
Lists, lots of lists.
Listicles, right. Lots of photo chains of adorable puppies and kittens. But, you know, by the time I started researching my book, BuzzFeed had branched into to news. But, you know, I was around when they had their biggest viral hit, which was simply a picture of a striped dress that asks, what color is this dress? And there are a lot of people who saw it as blue and black stripes, but others were certain it was white and gold. And before you knew it, 26 million people had clicked on what color is this dress.
Yeah.
It was, you know, a phenomenon that drew, by the way, news coverage from everybody, including the New York Times.
Yeah, and whether it was black or gold, it was certainly a click gold, and it made them a whole bunch of money. I was also fascinated to find that the writers at BuzzFeed, when they had a post ready to go, they were encouraged to come up with, you know, 6, 7, 8 different headlines mm-hmm. that they would sort of test to see if they created more or fewer clicks. And then the ones that ended up being more productive were the ones that they kept up longer. This is a, you know, it used to be the copy editors are the ones that made the headlines after a reporter, you know, submitted her story.
Those days are gone.
Yeah, and even at the New York Times, right? So now the Times and the Post, those folks are still
headlines.
Yeah, interesting. Jill Abramson, we're talking about her new book, Merchants of Truth: The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. One of the facts that we need to fight for here at WYPR from time to time is the fact that bringing you shows like Midday or any of the shows that you listen to every day cost money. And we are honored and blessed to have lots of people who are willing to contribute their money to assure that the programming you enjoy from NPR and WYPR is accessible not only to them, but to everyone in our listening area. If you'd like to join the WYPR family by becoming a member, we would love to have you. Here's Andy Bienstock to tell you how to make that happen. Thanks, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has made a contribution in this, our spring membership campaign. We appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and this programming note, usually on Mondays, I read the names of those people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore. We are not going to remember those people today. We will acknowledge them next Monday here on our program. My guest today is a groundbreaking reporter, editor, and author who has held some of the top journalism jobs in the country. Jill Abramson was the first woman to be named the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times. She went on to become the executive editor of that paper. The Times is one of 5 organizations that she writes about in her new book that explores the intersection between reporting and the business of journalism. The others are the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, and Vice. She also has a chapter on the important role Facebook plays in the dissemination of information around the world. The book is called Merchants of Truth: The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. So, Jill Abramson, we talked before the break a little bit about BuzzFeed and its partnership, its reliance on Facebook, the relationship that Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, had to keep with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. In the instance of Vice, they became a very video-oriented affair after publishing a magazine for a while. And they are very reliant on YouTube and now HBO. So these alliances that have been built around these new business models also create some pretty tricky situations.
They're very shape-shifting, of course they are. And now, you know, the relationships are fraught because, you know, Vice was very dependent on YouTube and fashioned much of its video programming to be seen on YouTube channels. And YouTube was purchased, of course, by Google, you know, quite a few years ago. But, you know, it's sort of like the platforms that enabled Vice and BuzzFeed to grow so big in their, you know, early incarnations and then grow to have valuations, you know, well into the billions of dollars are now, you know, the very sources that are starving them because Facebook and Google at this point are eating up, you know, most of the digital advertising. I think for new digital ads, it's something close to 90%. So the business models, including native advertising, because Vice also was, you know, a early pioneer of native ads. And in fact, its native ad studio had the cute name of Virtue. So there was Vice and Virtue.
Vice and Virtue,
but,
yeah.
But now, you know, that's not bringing in enough revenue to support these operations, which have, you know, grown big in the news space. But news, you know, isn't a moneymaker for either of them. It's sort of a loss leader that, you know, classes up their brands. But, you know, Jonah Peretti originally didn't want to have anything but native ads because he didn't want the clutter of click ads. And he's had to basically, you know, take any ads he can get at this point. And, you know, Vice, too, is struggling. And both companies have you know, laid off 250 people each, which is a big cut. And, you know, they were the shiny new upstarts challenging, you know, the old legacy newspapers when I began the book. And now they're the ones struggling. And, you know, papers like The Times and The Post are, you know, signing up lots of new paying subscribers. So it's sort of the story really switched on me, which was interesting but challenging, too.
Yeah, the new media organizations are by no means immune to the same kinds of pressures that old media has faced. But it's interesting now that the advertising online at The Post and The Times and places like that, or the Boston Globe where you live, or the Baltimore Sun where I live, you know, classified ads since 2000 down 80% for local newspapers. And of course, we're talking about The Post and The Times as national newspapers. The decimation of local newspapers is another thing you write
about. Yeah, we should definitely
about.
Talk a bit about that because, Tom, you were emphasizing at the very beginning of the show, you know, the lack of a trusted news source that people can't name one, but in virtually every survey I've looked at, the most trusted source of news is local newspapers, and they're a vanishing breed. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard the phrase news desert. And, you know, if local papers haven't had to shutter, many of them have been taken over by vulture capital funds, which strip them down for parts so that, you know, basic institutions like city councils and zoning boards aren't covered. Even state capitals aren't fully covered. And, you know, that's not a threat to journalism only. It's a threat to democracy because the founders of our country, you know, appointed us, the press, to be the watchdogs against abusive government power. And if, you know, news gathering muscles are so atrophied, we can't fulfill the reason why, you know, we're protected by the First Amendment. It's first for a reason.
You know, we're here on this program. We certainly want to have topics and conversations and guests that talk about things that people are interested in. We don't want to do things that, you know, subjects that nobody cares about. But the three pillars that we sort of base our operation here in our local public radio station in this program are the story selection, the things that we decide to cover, because we have to decide not to cover many more things than we decide to cover just because of the time in the day. The diversity of guests that we have, so we're having opinions and perspectives that come from across the community, across literally the world in terms of scholarly expertise and repertorial expertise. And then most importantly, accuracy. We want to make sure that the guests we have and the things that I talk about personally are whoever says anything on our air is saying things that are accurate. So we like it when people listen. We like when our ratings are good, and they are, thank God. And I'm, you know, delighted and pleased about that and grateful for that. But it's not the first impetus for why we do what we do. There's an organization, a company called Chartbeat. Tell us about Chartbeat, because there are newspapers now, even legacy newspapers, local papers, who are using Chartbeat as a metric for compensation of their editors and reporters even. Tell us what that does.
Chartbeat is a data service that measures down to the microsecond what people are reading and how long they're spending reading whatever they're reading. And so it's metrics that give, you know, it's like TV ratings. They give a very precise sense of how popular any particular news story is, whether to use a Jonah Peretti word, whether it's going megavi. And, you know, editors are not completely letting Chartbeat guide, you know, what stories they make most prominent in their news reports, but it's not ignored either. And reporters are very conscious of, you know, where they stand on Chartbeat. At the Washington Post, they have big monitors on every floor where you can see what the trending stories are. And, you know, reporters say, you know, it makes them feel insecure and bad when their stories aren't up there. One reporter there evidently spent some time talking to his psychiatrist about Chartbeat and his obsession with it. And, you know, reporters elsewhere have told me that, you know, if they write about President Trump, their story is gonna, you know, rise on Chartbeat, and other subjects aren't so surefire.
Jeff Bezos, who is one of the world's leading technologists, used his personal funds to purchase the Washington Post. It's not an Amazon company, but obviously the lessons he's learned from Amazon are things that he's applying to the Post. But we should mention that he was very quick to invest a lot in the newsroom of the Post after he purchased it a few years ago. I mean, is the firewall between the business side and the news side just now becoming a quaint anachronism? And are people like Jeff Bezos ultimately going to be the saviors, or are they going to continue to demonize and cut down further that firewall?
Well, the firewall still exists. I think in the digital world, it's become a little blurry because, you know, you need technology, design, and news to be fused together to create a great website or app. And those are kind of combo technology and design, certainly, you know, and product. Area called product are more conventionally business side features. But the firewall still exists. And, you know, I think Jeff Bezos has been, from all my reporting, a good steward of The Washington Post. He's definitely provided the resources to bring the quality of the newsroom back to really where it was in its glory days under Ben Bradley. Marty Baron is a fantastic editor. I don't think, you know, Bezos has interfered in any of the Post's journalism. Yeah. And I think the Graham family, you know, satisfied itself that that was not why he was buying
and
the Washington
Post. And we here at this program are very, very grateful to all the reporters at the Post, the Sun, and the Washington and the New York Times, because they appear on our program all the time, and we're grateful to them. We're also grateful to you, Jill Abramson. This is a really great read. It's a new book is called Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts, and I appreciate your time today, and good luck with it.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We want to thank the Diz for providing lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for this edition of Midday. Tomorrow, Dr. Sherry Parks joins me for another installment of Midday Culture Connections. And now we pause once again to thank everybody who has made their voice heard in this, our spring membership campaign. Our sustaining members make all the programs that you listen to possible.